I think we'll stick to that 10-minute time and just use this 10 minutes just to sort of very quickly set up the discussion that we'll come back to straight after lunch, and perhaps explain why we've got a session here on business combinations, which some of you may feel kind of came as a little surprise being the agenda. And the reason why we've added it in there was a little bit of a last-minute thought that was triggered by some of our conversations in the interim element of the project, but I think it does have implications for the main project as well. And it's connected with some comments that we had from the interim proposal, asking for more clarity and guidance on the interaction between the separate presentation and the isolation of the regulatory amount from amounts recognised in accordance with other IFRSs or other standards, and in particular on a business combination situation. Some of the questions in the exposure draft comment letters were saying, should it be the recognition and measurement criteria of the acquirer, or should it be the acquiree, or how does it work? And the discussion we had with the board about the interim standards was, well, it should obviously be coming from the point of view of the acquirer, because it's their consolidated financial statements that we're accounting in. But it did trigger some thoughts, and the decision, the tentative decision by the board, was that we will make some little tweaks in the interim standards to say, yes, it's the acquirer's accounting policies that count on recognition and measurement in a business combination, and will allow people to continue with their existing accounting policies. But it did trigger the question, what are people currently doing? And to try and help us in the longer term project to get a better picture for perhaps any future guidance that we might develop, we did want to try and have a conversation with you guys as an early opportunity to get a flavour for what's happening in different jurisdictions on business combinations, not just from a preparer point of view, but a valuation point of view, as well as a financial reporting point of view. So I appreciate we only sent the papers out a week ago, and you might not have had time to do much research and investigation, those that are not totally familiar. So it might be a topic that we come back to at a later stage as well, but we thought it's a good opportunity to first of all, identify what's happening out there. Secondly, to try and get a greater understanding of why it's happening, how things are valued, so that we can start thinking about the longer term project. So in agenda paper 3, we just have a series of questions, but I'm not sure if this captures everything that we should be asking. So if you've got any other answers to questions that are not asked in the paper, we'd be very, very happy to hear those answers as well. So I'm just conscious we've just got 5 minutes to go before lunch. If anybody wants to make any high-level comments now, so people can mull on those over the lunch break, otherwise we just get a bonus 5 minutes for lunch.
Yeah, when I read this paper, I just wanted to clarify, when we talk about book value, do we mean book value under the acquiree's existing GAAP? The reason I raise this is because you could be in a situation that you could buy one rate regulated activity in, say, Canada, pick that at random, and one in France, who are exactly the same, let's pretend, and one has a rate regulated asset, the other one doesn't, under IFRS, under Canadian GAAP. Is your assumption here that you keep the book values under Canadian GAAP and the book values under, I nearly said French GAAP.
Yes, I don't have an assumption, because my honest answer is I don't know what people are doing at the moment, and that's a good question that wasn't asked in the paper.
And then I've got a follow-up question, because I think that my own reading of IFRS 3 is that you could find yourself under IFRS recognising an asset or a liability in respect of a rate regulated right or obligation that is not currently recognised. So in particular, if I acquire my French company and they don't have a liability on their balance sheet, I'm pretty sure in my own mind that I've got a contingent liability that I would be required, well, I'm more than contingent liability, let's pretend here, that I would be required to recognise under IFRS 3. So there are a couple of...
I think Bill has a good point on that.
Definitely. Okay. Just generally on this, I mean, again, for people who haven't worked a lot with IFRS 3, there may be some anomalies you haven't spent time focusing on, and there are times when under IFRS 3 you might recognize something that you wouldn't recognize otherwise, or you might measure something in an amount that's different from what you would recognize on an ongoing basis. And I'm guessing that we're probably less concerned about those because they're kind of known places where IFRS 3 creates a one-off difference than from understanding other things that IFRS 3 business combinations accounting might raise in terms of the interactions more generally. But correct me if you think we do also need information about those IFRS 3. I'll call them anomalies. It's not a criticism of the standard. It's just saying it says these are transactions that create one-off special accounting.
I mean, I think I would like, if anybody has got any examples, for them to share those with us, because I find it quite difficult to find lots of examples of business combinations in either IFRS financial statements or others under US GAAP or old Canadian GAAP. That's primarily where I've been searching out. But it is quite interesting. I mean, the US standard for business combinations is very similar to IFRS 3. For those not familiar with IFRS 3, you can use that as your benchmark. But I am interested in if people do recognise under IFRS 3 one of these items that is related to regulation that you wouldn't normally account for, but you probably could under IFRS 3.
So maybe what we're trying to do is, you know, when we identify some of these things, determine if this is kind of a classic example, but if it's an industry-specific example of the anomalies that IFRS 3 creates, or if it's one of the other issues about continuity between previous GAAP and DISCOM.
Yeah, I want to say North America, or in Canada and the U.S., when you do a business com, it's my understanding, if it's not 90%, probably almost 100% of the cases, that you will recognize the regulatory assets and liabilities and then the property, plant and equipment at cost, not at cost, but at the net book value, no, at the rate base or the net book value that you have in the entity that you acquire. You will not fair value those elements. I don't know, this is when you're shaking your head, but I'm not sure you have a different. That's North America. I've got here some financial statement last quarter from one of the large ones. They're saying, you know, net book value is called fair value. And I've got a number of examples like that.
I think the difference I would offer, and we can get into it, is the enterprise value, which would go into equity, would be at fair value, but you would book the plant itself, the rate base assets, at book equals fair value. You'd assume it equals fair value because the regulator is giving you a fair return. So the fair value equals the historical cost because the regulator is basing its recovery and return on based on historical cost. But I think the shorthand that net book value equals fair value, I don't think is quite right. Because we would revalue debt at current rates, but then we book a reg asset or a liability because the regulator is going to give you the face value of the debt. But you, under US GAAP, have to book the debt at fair value at current rates. So we create a difference, there's a timing difference, and so we create new regulatory assets and liabilities for that timing difference. But in the plant, there is no timing difference because they're based on historical cost. And so now you could argue that in practice that's what we've done.
But if you talk about the other items, I was talking about the property, plant, and equipment, and the fixed assets and liabilities. I agree with
them.
With the other liabilities and the other assets, there are different approaches. Sometimes it's at cost or at net value, and sometimes it's at fair value.
These are exactly the sorts of issues that we were hoping would come out in conversation. So I'm really looking forward to this afternoon. But Michael.
I don't know where. I think two things. I think I don't think the description here that, you know, fair value is taken to book value is actually correct. I think what happens, and I think Dwayne's alluded to this, is that you are fair valuing the balance sheet of the acquired entity, but you need to look at what that fair value is, and PP&E is probably the most obvious one to look at, because the regulatory restriction around PP&E and therefore your ability to realise a value other than book value is extremely limited. So what happens is you work through the fair value assessment and you reach the conclusion that actually fair value equals book value because you've done that, as opposed to jumping to the well as a regulated entity, so it's just book value. And if what might apply to PP&E is where it says doesn't necessarily apply to other assets and liabilities on the balance sheet. And under US GAAP, where you might fair value debt and have an offset to a regulatory asset and liability, the question when you move to IFRS is, if you don't have a regulatory asset and liability, where does that offset actually land up? So is it intangible or is it goodwill? And I think there is a debate to be had, you know, around that. And then the other thing I think is to distinguish between fair value adjustments and GAAP differences. So to give an example there, in a US rate regulated environment, the way in which you will effectively accrue economically and from an accounting point of view for your cost of removal is usually to overcharge depreciation that you then get to recover. So you build up within your accumulated depreciation a hidden provision for the cost of removal of an asset. Now under IFRS, from an accounting point of view, you know, a cost of removal, provision means a legal constructive obligation is calculated on an NPV basis, sits in provision. That's a GAAP difference. That's not a fair value difference in all its own right. So there's two stages for me, which are, first of all, you've got to sort out your GAAP differences, and then you've got to look at fair value, or you've got to do it the other way around. But it's important to distinguish between fundamental differences in GAAP and approaches to fair value.
And I kind of agree what you have said in terms of the net book value, fair value. It's not automatic, you know. You have to do a fair value of net book value, and you would use an income-based approach. So you would do your cash flow projections, and your cash flow projections will be your rate of return, and then you would have your discount rate to bring it back to the value today. And the point is that you have to justify that your discount rate is the same or very similar to your rate of return. And normally what you would see is that people will go to the market and look at the risk-free rate and will adjust for the premium, and there would be further adjustments, and you would have a gap, not a gap, you would have a band of, let's say, 8 to 9%, that's the market rate to discount, and happens that your rate of return would be 8.5, so now you're in mid-range, so it's about, therefore, it's approximate, you know, the net book value equals fair value. It's not just an automatic statement that we make, you know. It has to be justified, and people see a long normally paper, you know, and files to support that.
I mean,
consider is also if we are trying to isolate the impact of the regulation from PP&E, which I know is different from US GAAP and old Canadian GAAP, the net book value isn't the rate base or doesn't even approximate the rate base, so that's just an added level that we need to consider. Yeah. Sorry, Karen.
So from an equity research perspective, there's really three sets of things you need to worry about here. The first is, from a rate regulatory perspective, whatever premium they paid to rate base or the equity portion of rate base and that fair value calculation that goes on in the market, the rate regulated entity to a certain extent, at least in Canada, is held harmless because they don't allow any premium to a rate base, for instance, or the equity portion of rate base to flow back in. So it's not going to affect costs or the cash flow of the utility. So there's this rate regulated entity that in effect is shielded from the change in control that's going on around it or the sale around it. And by and large, most regulators will not allow a purchase price discrepancy to go into rate base, and it will be a neutral from a rate perspective, so it won't change and affect the cash flow. Then you have the valuation exercise that goes on in the market to determine what is the value of the utility, mark the debt to market, mark the cash flow to market, and then you have the accounting adjustments. So I think it's important in the conversation that we're going to have after lunch that we're actually focused on the right part of the transaction and keeping in mind that there really is the three streams and that we need to be careful about what stream we're in and not to crisscross them too much.
Yeah. Thanks, Karen. Jesus, do you want to finish us off just for Len?
Okay. I think in some cases you are not you have to consider the book value as the reference of a regulated asset as a fair value in a business combination. The example here is here in the UK in relation with the airports, because in order to calculate which is the fair rate of return is not based on the book value for financial reporting purposes. It's a special book value that is regulated asset base that is different from the book value. And let me give you an example. For example, if you are building a new terminal and you overspend 5 million, the regulator can say, no, this is because it has been inefficient, and it's an inefficiency, and then I do not include this within the regulated asset base. So at the end of the day, when there is a business combination, as I just said, probably the reference to calculate which is the fair value is the regulated asset base, that is the amount that is used to calculate the fair rate of return.
Yeah.
So not the book value, is the regulated asset base.
Because your book value would include the overspend, is that
correct? Yes. Now, yes, from my point of view, it's not included. Because I think that book value will be near to the regulatory asset basis.
If the regulatory calculation purposes, you cannot take the 5 million in your example,
mm-hmm.
would there not be an impairment to the asset?
No, sorry.
Let's say it is a terminal, you cannot use it for any other purpose, but for airlines, just to give an example. Yeah, if there's an alternative use or something like that, I can get to it. But if it's specific to an airline terminal, I don't know whether I would say immediately that there is. I'm not saying there will always be impairment, but there could be impairment. We need to think about it.
Probably you could have a discussion about which is the minimum business you need to calculate the fair value, and probably you have to calculate the fair value with other terminals, because finally you are using your terminals for the only one purpose. So if we had a different unit or only one unit, so that would be a proxy of a risk of impairment, as you say.
Yeah.
Since PP&E doesn't automatically equal to rate base, you could have it in as an adjustment to your rate base calculation by putting it in no cost capital. So that way you would have your PP&E, including your $5 million, but in calculating rate base, you would have a negative offset for the $5
million. In any case, I think it's another discussion should be which is really the fair return. And probably you can have a discussion that the fair return that has been fixed by the government is not the fair return. And you had a bank discussing or a consultant that is making the evaluation that the return has to be calculated in a different way that is being calculated by the government.
Yeah.
Because discussing about fair rate of return is open to which is the beta, which is the market risk premium, and all so on.
Excellent. I think that sets us up very nicely then for this afternoon's session on business combinations. If we can break, please, for UAK, we said originally we'd come back at 1:40, and I know we finished slightly late, but are people still okay to come back at 1:40?
Yeah.
4 minutes later. Thank you. I'd like to just continue from where we left off, really, but perhaps if we can try and break it down into little sections, and perhaps if we can ask, first of all, if we can maybe focus on the valuation of the property, plant and equipment element of things, or the tangible assets or any specific intangibles, and identify from you how these things are valued, both for a valuation point of view and also a financial reporting point of view. I appreciate that not everybody is covered by IFRS 3, so perhaps if you're not talking about financial reporting under IFRS, then perhaps you can just give us an indication of what gap it is that you're reporting under. So, Jakob.
Jenny, maybe to mention for regulatory purposes, we do not use the cost base, we use a revaluation base. So, if you take it
cost method, where you can look at the modern equivalent asset value. For financial statement purposes, we haven't changed yet from a cost to a revaluation base, but we do disclosure in terms of what the income statement and the balance sheet would look like.
Right. So from your regulatory returns, it's based on
a revaluation basis.
Right. So you, got the opposite way around to what a lot of other people might have. Okay. Anybody else in terms of the property, plant and equipment element? Because we mentioned earlier about the asset base versus the net book value. And I'd be interesting, obviously, Jakob, you have a difference there between the asset base for regulated purposes and the net book value. Is there anybody else who's got a difference between the two?
In our experience, the asset base is recorded in our financial statements. So we use the book value as the fair value in our business combination. Usually, the difference between the acquisition cost and the book value is allocated as an intangible asset related to the rights for the concession.
Right. So any difference between the two automatically dropped.
Yes. Synergy, for instance, we consider as upside. We don't record goodwill synergy, for instance. As I mentioned here, it's not our case. Yeah.
Right. So you would allocate the entire purchase price to something.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you would go down the IFRS 3 route effectively to try and separately identify those other types of intangibles.
Yeah.
Does that mean then that, sorry, this is not a question asked in the paper, but it just triggered a thought, for the subsequent accounting, do you then amortise that other intangible asset?
Yes, we amortise during the concession period, yes.
Anyone else? Pascal, I know that you're under IFRS. Yes, you talked about your face.
Smile. Not for Richard, you're going to see we had to apply IFRS 3 when the Suez water gas was bought, it was in 2008. At that time, I think the assets were measured at under what we call the RAB, regulated asset base. No goodwill at the time because it was, in fact, it was a company we bought, and so we have to any goodwill on that or any difference or any intangible, and no more. Regulated assets and liabilities, because at that time the regulation was not really, I would say, the market, the open market was not really in place or as it is today. So the question was not raised at that time. Because we don't have, as it was mentioned, we don't have any rights or obligation because it was really the beginning of the opening of energy markets in Europe. So it was a different time.
If I understood well, so for your IFRS financial statements, you have recognized the RAB number, not the net book value, because there is a difference.
Yeah.
That's your fair value.
Yeah.
In our case, when I was saying earlier, in Canada, most of the time, if it's not almost all the time, the net book value is equal to the rate base. And I think it's in the premise under FAS 71 that if you have costs in your PP&E that are not allowed to be recovered, you need to make an impairment immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So technically, the two should be very close to each other. Mm-hmm. So that's why we don't have that issue. But at least what you're saying, you're using the RAB slash net book value adjusted to get the RAB. Okay, so it's the same.
If you want to, I can get you more details, but I don't remember all the details on that stuff. So that it was the RAB.
Okay.
I'm retired the RAB because we had some discussion about how to amortize these assets, and our principle is to take the tariff because
into the tariff there is a depreciation period, so we took that depreciation period to amortize the debt. Because in France, you know, we operate regulated business and the legal environment of concessions, so that's really a mess, I would say.
Yeah. But your RAB, your asset base, wouldn't be the same as your accounting net book value, presumably.
No, not
believe me.
Okay. I still forgot. That's the first time I the question. So because it was not a specific business, it was part of a. So it was not a separate business, I would say. We bought an asset.
Ah, so
it
was an asset.
It was an asset.
It
was part of the business combination, but Gaz & France was involved in gas supply, in exploration production, in grid, in transport, it was an asset. So that's why I don't have the answer to that question. Was not a specific entity. That's why we didn't end up with a goodwill too.
But it was an asset, but you use IFRS 3 as a business combination.
Yeah, yeah, but it was a group.
Transport
and was part of the business.
So you did a business combination with a group that had many activities,
yes.
And then there was a group of assets within that business that had...
Yeah, we used that. Michael?
Yeah, I've just... give you two examples of fair value adjustments on a business combination of a rate-regulated activity. So in the round PP&E, so the first one was where, and I don't want to debate why the entity hadn't recorded this, but there was a regulatory disallowance across part of their asset base, which the entity hadn't recorded. So when we came through the business combination, and you look at that asset on a standalone basis, it's not as part of a total business, total balance sheet. That regulatory disallowance flowed through to the fair value of PP&E on the business combination. And the second one was where the entity had a regulatory asset. So when you looked at it, in effect, the costs that were being recovered were PP&E related, but wouldn't necessarily qualify for PP&E accounting. Those cash flows were wrapped up in the fair value assessment of PP&E such that there was a fair value uplift. So if you like, the regulatory asset, it got rolled up into the PP&E balance and then didn't appear on the IFRS balance sheet.
So it's basically a summation of both, you know,
the
rate base plus the regulatory asset because it's related to PP&E. An alternative would have been an intangible for that regulatory asset or part of the life or whatever. You know,
that's a separate discussion.
Correct. That's the next one.
I think that that's part of the complication, isn't it? Because it's the fair value. It sounds to me there that the fair value was recognised as being effectively the regulatory asset base because you were rolling up those amounts that couldn't be recognised in the book value for financial reporting purposes, but obviously were included in there, which make it become part of PP&E because IFRS 3 says your starting point is the fair value of PP&E.
And that's why the sort of fair value equals book value notion is a little bit too narrow an approach to it. I mean, you may land up there, but there's a thought process, which means you also might not if you've got some of these disallowances or other aspects.
But my net, just to again to requalify what I said earlier this morning, is that my net book value equal my rate base as a starting point and equal my fair value. You don't have difference between them. And then obviously you have the computation and all the discount rates.
Actually, that's the point. Those people that were fair valuing, which discount rate did you use? Was it a market rate or a rate that was given by the regulator as being the rate of return? Yeah, if you can't remember, that's fine. Just like
well, in the U.S., I actually gave a chance to talk to. The guy who does most of our evaluation work from Duff and Salt, and he does many utility valuations across the U.S. And generally, we would apply the allowed rate of return to the property, plant, and equipment. But what you're applying in valuing the enterprise in terms of identifying the purchase, what's going to go to equity, the purchase price, you know, you're looking more at. The spot cost of capital at that point in time. So utilities in the U.S., typically regulated utilities, will trade at 1.5 to 1.8 times book. So there is a premium where interest rates are today, and generally in valuation space, Phelps tells me that they would assume the spot rate on the way U.S. GAAP is today, that you'd assume that spot rate in perpetuity, whereas the regulator is looking at a rate of return on a lifespan of specific assets. So there's really two different valuation frameworks and time spans that you're looking at. And so that's how I had a lot of debate with people over the years about, well, why aren't you using the market cost of capital that the purchaser is getting in the marketplace today as your discount rate for the future. But the reality is the future cash flows you're going to get include the return on equity that's already built in to the allowed rate of return.
Yeah.
So you kind of, in practice, you just default to the to that approach is what I see. And then regulatory assets and liabilities, typically, there's not uniformity in practice. You know, technically, you probably should be discounting them back at, if they only back up. If you are only getting recovery of the regulatory asset and no return on it, and it's a longer-term type regulatory asset, an argument could be made that you should be discounting that back at an imputed interest rate, if you will. But in practice, we've never done that, and Dr. Phelps tells me he's not really seen that done in practice either in the U.S. space.
Okay, so those would carry across.
So they come over at notional value, if you will, at book value.
At book value.
Yeah.
And would the same then apply to those that the regulator does allow a rate of return on those longer term regulatory assets? But in that case, you get back to book value because you're
in that case, I think technically it is book value, whereas if you're not earning return on, there could be an argument made that you should be reflecting an imputed interest
component. Thank you. That's useful. So you end up with the same treatment, even though they might be two slightly different.
Yeah. And most of the regulatory asset liabilities are not super long term, so you don't have
it. May not be material.
Material.
Yeah. Except things like Hurricane Katrina, where it's 10-year period, but
something
unusual. Does anybody else like to add their?
So what Dwayne has explained is substantially the same, I believe, in Canada in terms of the discount rates that you would see used. From an equity research perspective, we would have used the rate base of the entity to determine the relevant valuation range. So I was quite happy that he told us the range is 1.5 to 1.8 times book value, because most of the transactions that I've witnessed doing that job were in that same range. And some of the larger ones were about 1.7 times book. They might have gone through the bottoming a little bit, but we would definitely have used the rate base to ascertain fair value and determine from an investment perspective whether the entity was being too aggressive on pricing or not aggressive enough. And I would only make the note that given the fact that any purchase price discrepancy could not be recovered in rate base, then what that would generally push the overall entity to do would be to lower its cost of capital by introducing more leverage into the transaction than would be allowed by the regulated capital structure if there was one, or an implied capital structure and rates. So that's how those types of transactions would be accretive. You would introduce more leverage than is reflected in the underlying utility.
Michelle, you were going to...
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I've got, in front of me, I've put two valuations done by two of our clients, and they're using, you know, a capital asset pricing model, where they're taking into account the expected risk-free rate in the market, the add-up if it's a risk on it, to take into account sensitivity to market risk for security. And in one of the two cases, they're adding up on the top of it a size premium that is related to the size of the transaction as opposed to the normal transaction in the market. So it's really, you know, and with that, they come to, again, a range of rates, and they're looking at their rate of return, and they're assessing my rate of return within that range. If it's within that range, why not using that number for that rate? It's just falling in it.
Right. So
but they're using the rate they're permitted to earn by the regulator as a right. as a check almost.
But it's good personal calculation, you know, and it's done by an external, you know, consultant as well.
Thank you. Any other comments? Anybody on the phone that would like to add any comments? Okay. Thank you. That's been very helpful in terms of an initial fact-finding exercise. And perhaps if anybody is willing to forward to me any of the more detailed information that you've got, then please do that. It will help in the research for the long-term project. And it may be something that we come back to at a later stage. But as an initial conversation, that was very helpful. So thank you.
There's one thing we've not addressed, or just partially addressed with Michael. Is under IFRS, I think we kind of agree here that they're going to use the rate base as the fair value in a business comp. What has not been clear to me, except in one case, is the regulatory asset and liabilities that you may acquire. Is it recognized as part of the PP&E? That's one solution. If it's not that, where is it? Is it part of the goodwill? I would say, no, I think I've got an asset here. Is it, I would say, it's an intangible. What type of intangible? Is it part of my license? Is it part of something? I would say it's part of something. And I would say license, and therefore when I'm going to get the revenue going forward, I will amortize that intangible to offset it, not to have the room, because I purchased that revenue. So is it something which is being done currently under IFRS, or is it just always embedded in the PP&E, like Michael suggested, at least in this case, in one case?
I don't want
to... In case you didn't have anything to answer, as you said, I'm just wondering if the other, that they have...
One example was provided that they filed by Elia. They bought 50 Hertz, but they booked some assets, regulated assets and liabilities. And that's...
And they call them regulatory assets and liabilities.
Yeah. I don't know. They have a special word I wrote in, so it's just... That's assets and liabilities. Because Elia does have a liability in IFRS financial statements because of a law that said that it's not... cannot be profit for the company, so they have to book a kind of default, I don't know what exactly, not profit, so it's just a special account. And this is a personal, but because I was a question I had, if you book an asset or liability, what's the P&L the next year, how do you amortize it, and what the performance of the company is going to be.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah. I deal with it all, but it disappears, so.
Maybe we'd like to ask.
Yeah. We have a meeting in 2 weeks, so I'm going to ask. I think the situation under IFRS is very confused at the moment. I mean, I think, as Michael said, some of it will... I'd say accidentally, but that sounds a bit rude. Some of it will drop into the PP&E value because it's the fair value calculation. So the rate base, from what I'm hearing, is perceived to be the fair value because of the way that things work. So some of what would perhaps be thought of as a regulatory asset and liability actually does become the PP&E because of the way that IFRS 3 works. What's less clear, I think, are some of the other regulatory balances that we don't see coming across, and it sounds as though possibly sometimes it might be shown as a separate intangible, either totally separately or part of the value of the license, if we've got a license that we can recognise going forward. But it's something that to me isn't clear now, and it's something that we need to try and get more clarity on, and I'm not in this meeting going to make any attempt whatsoever to suggest how we might actually deal with this going forward, because like I said, the purpose of this session was to do the fact finding to help with our understanding so that we can think about it in the longer term. But otherwise, thank you very much indeed. That takes us then